So, for this evening's talk, I was like, breaking new ground, just going where no monk has gone before, as I said last week. So, I'm going to start, because it's inappropriate for this time of year, a little question for you to start this off. So, I'm looking for it here. A question for you. If you can start the day without needing caffeine, if you can always be cheerful, ignoring aches and pains, if you can resist complaining and boring people with your troubles, and if you eat the same food every day and be grateful for it, if you can understand when your loved ones are too busy to give you any time, if you can take criticism and blame without resentment at all, if you can conquer tension without medical help, and you can relax without alcohol, and if you can sleep without the aid of drugs, who are you? The answer is, the dog. And I'll read it again. It's true. Listen to it again. If you can start the day without needing caffeine, dogs don't take caffeine. They don't need it. You can always be cheerful, ignoring aches and pains. Have you ever seen a dog complain? If you can resist complaining and boring people with your troubles, you can eat the same food every day and be grateful for it. If you can understand when your loved ones are too busy to give you any time, if you can take criticism and blame without resentment, bad dog, they just sit there smiling, wagging their tail. Really wise. If you can conquer tension without medical help, if you can relax without alcohol, and you can sleep without the aid of drugs, a dog. Okay. A dog is on value. Oh, what is this world come to? What is this world coming to? When I was a young monk, I never saw any dogs on valley. Oh, goodness gracious me. But anyway, most dogs, except for the president's friend's dog. There's always exceptions which prove the rule. But the reason is, the talk today, which I thought of at the last moment, because this is the year of dogs, the dog, this is Buddhism and dogs. I've given this talks before, like in Buddhism and bananas before, and it's very amazing wise. As you can find it online, Buddhism and coffins, which is really amazing. And just a little plug for Judy, because, you know, I was asking about the arrangements. Judy Rushforth, you know, many of you, if you saw her, you know, just coming here and meditating, go to retreats, very helpful. But her family told me that she doesn't want a big ceremony, and that she just has already got, doesn't want a casket, literally a cardboard box, which you can do that. You know, it's obviously hygienic. So a cardboard box is much more better for the environment. You don't need to impress your friends with how big your casket is. You know, I came from a really big home. Look at my mansion, so my casket should be something, you know, up to that. Because, look, this happened once in all my funeral stories. Nothing to do with dogs, but anyway, here we go. But there was this, Chinese funeral. They really wanted to do their best, you know, for their father who passed away. And so they got the most expensive coffin, the most expensive casket, and they had all these ornaments on the outside, you know, of the casket. And it was a burial, so I was doing the burial for it. It had so much stuff put on the outside, every possible extra, you know, they got, you know, because, you know, your father, you've got to respect them. And so when they lowered it into the hole, it got stuck halfway down. Honestly, it got stuck. And they couldn't dislodge it, they couldn't pull it up, they couldn't lower it down. And I always remember this, because I was doing the funeral chanting, it usually only lasts for 1 minute. I kept on the next verse, the next verse, the next verse, as I was trying to pull it up and lower it down and pull it up and lower it down. I was getting hoarse, so I was thinking, the next one's going to be in the box. you know, because unfortunately they managed to dislodge it at the last moment. So you don't need to do that, for goodness sake. Just, you know, keep it simple. So that's, you know, I've already given my sort of, my last request to my monks, and when I die, that, you know, that I want to, you know, forget about cardboard boxes. I want to go in the mulcher. The mulch, like, you know, with the leaves and the twigs, and go straight back to the earth, very, very quick. So, is it a good idea? Yeah, very good idea. Oh, come on. Anyway, let's go back to dogs. So, it's nice when you see, like, the dogs, you know, sometimes we look down upon dogs. But, you know, there's so many of the monks, you know, my old tradition, used to say, you learn from nature. You know, you can learn from looking around you and just see just how some of the trees and flowers and plants, how they work. I often say, water the flowers, don't water the weeds. And, you know, you see just the way the trees are always bent and crooked, and they're the most beautiful ones. And see the animals as well, and so sometimes the dogs. And there's so many beautiful qualities in a dog. And then, you know, the dog, you know, of course, you know, they're always faithful, and they don't have much stress. It's amazing how these dogs worked it out in evolution. Sometimes we think we're higher beings, but they're much worse. How many dogs have to go to work on a Monday morning? When you think about it, they just sleep around all day. And I know some monks like that. Now, don't put them down. They're very wise. They're smart. They've evolved. They don't worry about what other people say about them. Lazy. But isn't it the case? They don't worry. They're not really concerned what other people think of them. Which is one of the great things, you know, about some of the animal worlds. We are just so worried about our appearance, you know, about our reputation, about what other people think about our fashion. That's one of the lovely things about being a monk. You just don't have fashion. So this was, you know, 25 centuries ago, and it's stuck like this. And but it's so wonderful because you've just got one robe, and you don't have to worry. You don't need a wardrobe. You just know it's all the same colour. And this, I say, very, very practical. Practical because, you know, I'm not a dog, so I have my caffeine, my cup of tea. If I ever, and you know, maybe a cup of coffee, if ever I spill anything on this, you don't have to wash it. Because it's already brown. That is the secret of why we have brown robes. You know, it probably started off white a long time ago, but, you know, a nice bit of coffee here and tea there, and you can't tell. And also, because I say that, you know, I travel a lot. Actually, on Monday, I'm going to Hong Kong. And when you travel a lot, it means that, you know, that sometimes, well, there are accidents on the air. And so this is my parachute. Well, you just, you know, hold on to the four ends. It's a really big. It's about 3 meters by 2 meters. Maybe you won't land as, you know, softly as a real one, but you can just float down. And I think that's probably where they got the idea of monks levitating, just floating down a parachute. But anyway, and also I mentioned this, because sometimes that, you know, when I think it was a Singapore Airlines, no, was it? A Malaysian Airlines flight got over, was it Syria or over Middle East or somewhere? Yeah, Russia, okay, because now sometimes they say, well, you know, Ajambabi, you actually survive a landing if you're going over to a place like London or something and you get shot down over the Middle East. What's going to happen to you? You know, number one, you're white. Number two, you're infidel. So what should I do? And I worked it all out straight away. What I need, this robe is so practical, a little slit in here, up on my head, and it's my burqa. And no one ever knows. Just a little slit in here, that's all I need. So that's why it's very, very helpful. And anyway, and it's also my, you know, when you sort of, I mentioned this to somebody just the other day that, you know, they were doing a little interview about, you know, how Bodhinyana started the monastery down at Serpentine. And it's, you know, it was true. The very first night, went there. We did some chanting, but first night down, I couldn't find where I was supposed to be sleeping. Wandered around, and my flashlight just lost all its energy, so it was really dark, and so, you know, no place to go, just under a tree. So I slept there, and this was my little blanket. It didn't work very much, but, you know, it was the best I had. So yes, we use this as my bed sheet as well. So it's so practical. And, of course, I think I told that last week about, you know, it's so practical that, you know, that's when I got that invitation to the state dinner at Parliament House with Queen Elizabeth II. Ooh, that was a very high-class invitation. And, you know, I was busy, but, you know, when I told people, that, you know, this is such a great invitation for the Buddhist Society, you know, to state parliament in Canberra, no, not state, so federal parliament, in the Grand Hall of Parliament House for a dinner with Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II. I thought, wow. And when I looked at the invitation card, there was a problem. That's right, you got it, dress code. Well, I mean, it's not like, you know, going to McDonald's or something, you know, just having a bit of, even going to Bodhinyana Monastery or Giji Ganap, you know, very rarely see a dress code down there. But anyway, they came and I looked at the invitation. Three choices. The first one was black tie. Now, look, I was a monk, okay, and out of circulation for such a long time, I didn't know what black tie meant. I thought, you know, that's what it said, black tie. Just go there with a black tie, no shirt, no trousers. But that's what it said. And they told me, no, you get arrested if you do things like that. A black tie is code. You know, they say these things, it means much more than that. So black tie meant, you know, the shirt, the jacket, the suit, the whole works. We haven't got a suit in monastery. And certainly we haven't got even a tie, let alone anything else like that. So I couldn't go. So choice number two. You know what choice number two was? Military uniform. You know, we're monks, we're pacifists. You can't go in a military uniform as a monk. Oh, crikey, what should I get next? So anyway, I looked at choice number three. Yes, I could go. Choice number three was long dress. So this robe is really helpful. You can go out a long dress. That was really good fun when I went there. There's all these other sort of people in their suits. You know, that one thing which I did do, I always kicking myself, I should have had a donation envelope, because you went, you know, like everybody else, into the toilets, into the loo. You know who I was in the urinal next to? Lachlan Murdoch. Oh, yeah. And I was in the toilet and I didn't have a donation envelope to give to. All our financial worries could have been solved in the space of one urinal meeting. It's amazing who you meet these days. But anyway, this was, I shouldn't go any further on that direction. But anyway, so I stopped at the security. Are you supposed to be here, sir? And I flashed my card, so I got in, so that was good. So anyway, so it's nice and simple, you know, what you learn from this life. But now, for dogs, it's sometimes we look down upon dogs in some traditions, because in some traditions, you know, we say that, you know, we call a person, you know, a dirty dog. Or, you know, this was one of Ajahn Chah's stories. Because when I first went to the northeast Thailand, it was 1974 when I became a monk, and there was still, the Vietnam War was still happening. And there's a big United States Air Force base close to Ubon, you know, where Ajahn Chah's monastery was. And so they were told the story, there was an African-American soldier who was in one of the old cycle rickshaws, going from the base into town. I don't know what he was going to do. And he was, you know, the driver was cycling along, and he passed like a roadside, it was like a bar, you know, where the, some of his mates were drinking, you know, cheap whiskey and getting more and more sozzled. And now when you take alcohol, you always, you know, you just lose, you know, your common sense and many other things as well. And so they looked at this, their friend, driving this African-American soldier into town. And, you know, they were really racist. And they, because they were drunk, they said, "Where are you taking that dirty dog to?" Pointing at the African-American. And this was a soldier, he was a big guy. You know, he could just, you know, do a lot of damage to those drunken little Thai people. And so the driver was very, very scared. He looked around. You know, this soldier was just looking around, smiling. He obviously could not understand the local language. So they said, "Look how dirty he is. We're going to take him into town and throw him in the river for a nice wash. Ha, 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 ha." And the soldier was just looking around, smiling. They thought they had a joke at his expense. But when they got into town, the driver got out of the rickshaw and started walking away. And the driver shouted out, "Hey, sir, you've got to pay me first." And this African-American soldier turned around and said in perfect Thai, "Dogs don't have money." That's the way to deal with abuse. You can always turn it around on the other person if you don't react. The problem is with us, you know, somebody abuses us, calling us names, you know, we react and we make it worse. There's always something you can do. It's actually to turn the tables in your favour. So, because of that, that's what right, you know, great insight is. And when you can actually, you know, people don't do the right thing, and you can use your wisdom. Right? I remember this person. I can say this because it wasn't our local council. I always got to be careful because, you know, we always need permission for this and permission for that. But there was one of the friends over here. He had a vehicle workshop, you know, mending people's cars, in one of the suburbs of Perth, but not City of Stirling, because I've, you know, got to be kind to City of Stirling, because, you know, just in case we need something for something or other. But anyway, he got to work on a Monday morning, and there was a car illegally parked across his driveway. And, you know, he says, "I can't even get my own car into the workshop, let alone get any people, any business cars coming in or you know, the fixed cars coming out." So he rang up the local council, a ranger came, and they stuck a sticker on the car. And they reported. He said, "Is that all you're going to do?" He said, "Yeah, that's the law. We have to keep the sticker on. After 7 days, then we can take it away." After 7 days! I've got my business! "You mean I can't do any business work? It's a law, sir. I'm sorry, nothing we can do about it." So this was a very smart person. Always think outside the box. Don't get angry. Just be wise. So what this guy did, he got his car. He couldn't get into his workshop anyway. He went to the local Shire Council offices and parked his car across the driveway of the car park. At which point they said, "Come, you can't use you can't park your car there. It's illegal. You know, the councillors can't come in out. Not even the mayor, he can't come out." And this guy said, "Put a sticker on it." "And I'll move it in 7 days." And of course, both cars were moved pretty quickly after that. So I thought that was actually pretty neat. Anyway, maybe I can get in trouble for that. So don't you try that. Anyway, about, yeah, the dogs. So, this is, Ajahn Chah, in some cultures, they say, you know, if you call a person a dog, that's really, really sort of an offensive thing to do. So what Ajahn Chah used to teach me, because I remember this happened only last week, I think, somebody said that at school the kid was being bullied and they kept calling him a dog. So what happens if they call you a dog? And Ajahn Chah used to teach us, if someone calls you a dog, you've got to look at your bottom. See if you've got a tail. If you haven't got a tail, you're not a dog. End of problem. it was a wonderful little way of dealing with criticism and abuse. If someone criticizes you, abuses you, you know, just have a look at your tail. See if you're a dog. You haven't got a tail, you're not a dog. End of problem. So, instead of getting angry back, it means you say to the person, sorry, sir, you got it wrong. I'm not a dog. But, going back to, you know, the Buddhism and dogs, you know, sometimes, maybe this is in Western culture, that sometimes we have these animals who become icons of wisdom. It's not just, you know, things like, you know, Winnie the Pooh, which I often quote. It's just, you know, other great dogs in Western culture. And of course, one of the greatest of those wise dogs of Western culture was Snoopy. You know Snoopy in the Peanuts cartoon and Charlie Brown? Why is it, in Peanuts, yeah, why is it that dogs in the cartoons always outwit human beings? Are we really the pinnacle of evolution? Are we? You know, this came to me. I'm going to get into trouble again with this, but who cares? I'm always in enough trouble. Anyway, I'm leaving the country on Monday morning, so I'm pretty safe. They always, I remember, because I was brought up in Christianity, they always said that God created man in an image of himself. Now, an image. Now, God created man in his image. If you look at any writing in a mirror, you find the image is back to front. G-O-D, so back to front, that must be dog. That's an image, isn't it? So maybe we got it wrong. And the real leaders of this universe are the dogs. Remember? So anyway, that's why the priests, they wear dog collars. There must be something in that. Have a think about it. This is breaking new ground, seeing things in a different way. So anyway, but dogs are very wise, I say. But there's something about, you know, the dog we can learn. It's just, you know, just, again, just the unconditional love they have for the people who look after you. I know sometimes that unconditional love, which you can learn, you know, from animals, especially, you know, a cat, you know, is just, you know, there's a princess, you know, needs to be sort of, you know, pampered. But a dog would do anything. And that's something which is really quite impressive. And there's all these wonderful cases, you know, the dogs who, you know, stay by their person. You know, and sometimes even wake them up in the middle of the night. Remember these stories, there's a fire, and the dog will wake you up to make sure that you escape. The dog is sometimes incredibly wise, and sometimes we do, I reckon, just underestimate, you know, the wisdom, you know, of dogs, especially the kindness, the unconditional kindness, you know, of a dog. And somebody asked me, because it does happen, that you know, the dogs get very sick. And I remember this story because this was actually told to me by Judy, you know, who's do a ceremony for on Sunday. She was the one, I often quote, that she had a little dog and, you know, had cancer. You know, dogs have cancer as well. And this little dog, here's your dog, you look after it to the max. She took it to the vet so many times, she said it cost a lot of money. But eventually she took it to the vet, and the vet told her, nothing more we can do. I've got to give it an injection. Euthanize it. In other words, kill it. Now, you know, for someone who's, you don't have no need to be a Buddhist, but just someone sensitive, you know, this is your animal, your friend, your pet, you know, and to put it down like that, to kill it, it doesn't make any sense. But, you know, you can't sort of afford to, you know, to keep on looking after it. And it just, you know, reminded me of that other person who took their dog to the vet, and the dog took one look at it and said, look, there's nothing I can do for your dog because your dog is dead. So it's not dead. You know, it's just meditating or something. It can't be dead. You know, because when, you know, you love something so much, you know, you just go into denial. So the vet said, look, come here. He put the dog just on the table. And the dog wasn't moving at all. And he got a little cat out of one of the cages, always being treated for something or other. And he took this cat and put it right into the nose. You know, the dog's nose, the cat's nose, almost touching. And the cat was going, and the dog was just actually not doing anything at all, not reacting. And that was really weird because, you know, she said her dog was really just, you know, very, very antagonistic and violent to cats. And so he turned the dog upside down on his soft belly and put the cat right on top of it. The dog never moved. And then lastly, put it down, lifted up its tail, and put the cat's nose right on the bottom of the dog. The cat too, the dog was actually motionless. And at that, the owner said, my dog would never allow that to happen to him if it was alive. The dog must be dead. That's the only way he could convince them that the dog was dead. And so fine, put the cat back in the cage and gave him the bill. $1,010. $1,010, that's a bit much. What's that for? Well, $10 for just the initial consultation and the $1,000 for the cat scan. Cat scan. Oh, come on. If you didn't expect that, you shouldn't come to a joint like this. Anyway, let's go. So back to poor Judy. So her dog was alive, but, you know, was dying. So can we euthanize it? What would you do? You love this cat. What should I do? So what she did, she remembered something which I said to her, because, you know, Buddhists aren't supposed to kill animals. So we're in a moral dilemma. You know, should we break one precept and just, you know, keep the and kill the animal, or should we just let the animal suffer? Compassion or precepts, which one should we do? And of course, you can always, there's a way of keeping it both, always win-win. So I told her before, and this is what she did. She took the cat. Can I have 5 minutes? Sorry, can I have 5 minutes with my little pet dog? And so, of course you can. And so she took it to a corner, looked into the dog's eyes, looked into it, and just asked the question, are you ready to go? Do you want to die? Ask the question. Just like I mentioned to your own legs, you know, are you comfortable down here? Because that's mindfulness, that's connecting. That's, you know, your mind, intuition, whatever you call it, connecting to, you know, your own legs. This is to your animal you've loved, you've been with for such a long time. And you'll know. And she knew. The dog didn't want to go. The dog didn't want to die yet. So what happened? She went back to the vet and told the vet, no, I'm taking my dog home. And the vet really exploded her, scolded her. You Buddhists, you say you're compassionate, you know, you say these things but you never do them. You know, you're just so selfish, you know, keeping these stupid precepts, you know, you stupid Buddhists, get out of here. Very upset at her. But then what happened was 6 months later, she brought the dog back to the vet. It made a full recovery and lived many more years. And, of course, the vet had a quick look at it, the same dog, and said, wow, you Buddhists are so wise. But because of that, I've said that so many times. I remember giving that at a group of lawyers in UWA, and about two of them put their hand up. Yeah, I heard you say that, you know, a year or two ago. I practiced that. It works. And it does. Don't underestimate, you know, an animal, even like a, you know, your dog. You know, you've been with that. You should know, you know, that, you know, what they, where they are at And they know much better than you. Because a lot of times when you're putting it down, it's putting it out of your misery. Not putting it out of the dog's misery. Let the dog make that call. And once you learn that out of things like dogs and cats, this is not demeaning human beings. We always think, oh, human beings are just so much more high, more intelligent, more advanced. If that's your mother or your father in a coma, and the doctor, you know, says, you have to make that decision. Should I turn off the life support? Should I keep it going? And it's your decision. What would you do? Or rather, how do you make that decision? How you make that decision is, again, you ask your father. But in a coma, doesn't matter, you can still make that connection. Are you still there? Or are you gone? Now, a lot of times, that a person, their body may be just still going on ventilators and stuff, but you should know whether they're still there, their stream of consciousness and mind, you know, whether that is still in there. And it's not that hard to know. And you'll be able to tell straight away. If they say, no, nothing there, then turning off the life support systems is not killing. They're already gone. They're dead. So it's a wonderful way, which is incredibly practical. I've done that many, many times. And you know, it works. So this is actually what we can learn from animals. They know what to do. But if they do pass away, because people ask that question, kids ask that question. You know, when a dog dies, what happens? Do dogs get reincarnated? Do dogs go to heaven? With the good cats as well? Chasing each other around. It's not much fun for the cats. So, what happens? And I don't know if this lady's here, but it was one of the ladies who used to come to Nolamara some years ago. She told me this amazing story of a ghost dog. Now, some people say, oh, come on, ghosts. You know, Ajahn Brahmi just, you know, just believe in aliens and goodness knows what else. But, you know, I was a theoretical physicist. And I keep on mentioning one of my best friends who came to our conference, Bernard Carr, student of Stephen Hawking's. We used to go hunting ghosts together. They exist. So this is not being someone who's just a crackpot. Now, I don't tell crackpot jokes, but this is not a joke. So anyway, this particular ghost. Actually, let's go back a bit. This woman, I think she had a partner who passed away, lived by herself with her dog. And they were so close together. Every morning, they'd go for a walk, and they'd go up to the... in the forest. You know, play around, have a good fun. Come back again, I think in the evening as well. Twice a day, just having a sort of taking the dog for a walk. What often happens is, you know, the dog takes you for a walk. And anyway, there they were. And one day when she came back from the walk, she'd lost a finger ring. And she lost a finger ring. She went back, you know, with the dog. It's a stupid thing to do, because in a forest, how can you find something like a finger ring? And amongst all those leaves and twigs all over the place. But she gave it a try, couldn't find it at all. It was lost. She knew roughly where it was lost, but, you know, couldn't find it at all. So she gave up on trying to find her finger ring. A few days later, she forgot all about her finger ring because her dog died. And so the dog died. I don't know what she did with it. But anyway, she came and told me, you know, here, in this temple here, she said a weird thing happened. For days afterwards, she could hear the dog barking in her house. And she knew that that was the sound of her dog. And if you live with a dog for such a long time, spend so much time with it, of course you know that that's, you know, the sound of your dog. But it was never in sight. It was always in another room. And of course, she missed the dog so much, she ran to the other room, opened the door, nothing there. And, you know, couldn't hear any more barking. She heard it so often. but could never see the dog. Always says no, in another room, one step ahead of her. Until, she said, one day she heard the dog barking outside the front door of her house. And she was on the other side, just maybe 6 inches, but a big pane of wood in front and between her. She quickly, as fast as she could, opened the door, hoping that now she would find a glimpse of her dog. Dog wasn't there at all. But in the very middle of her welcome mat was her finger ring. And that's the last she heard of her dog. The dog had done one last thing, find a finger ring for the person who loved her so much. Now that is a beautiful little story. How these animals, are they really animals? Are we going to say they're just way ahead of human beings, or human beings way ahead of what? You can learn so much from them, just the kindness and the faithfulness, you know, of some of these animals. And you know, sometimes that I mentioned here, you know, you don't get upset, you don't feel angry, sometimes you don't feel guilty. Because that idea of guilt is something which is such a human emotion. And sometimes it means we don't have that unconditional love which we can learn from animals. And of course, that story is one thing which really impressed me with when I first read about Buddhism. We just don't have punishment. When you look at the rules for a Buddhist monk or nun, you know, there's no sort of real punishments there. It's always, you've heard this before, acknowledge, forgive, learn. I say that over here in Australia, AFL code. You acknowledge what happened. If you made a mistake, you forgive it. Forgiving means no punishment. When you're not afraid of acknowledging, because if you have some punishment, you won't acknowledge, you'll deny it. It didn't happen, it wasn't me, I wasn't responsible. But when we acknowledge, because we know we'll be forgiven, then we have the opportunity of learning from mistakes we make at life. So, the story behind this, which is like an animal story, not really dogs, but this was a cat story, but dogs would do. This was one of the young men training to be a monk in Bodhinyana Monastery. Now, remember, those of you who visit, and sometimes you see some of the men in white, and ladies in white, that's Robin is going to ordain tomorrow. She's been an anagarika. How long is it? 1 year? 2 years? Almost 2 years, yeah. But anyway, what we usually do, 1 year in white training to be a monk, and then another year as a novice, and then another year before you become a full monk. So, you know what we call that? Quality control. To make sure you get, you know, because, you know, you expect a lot, you know, from the monks and the nuns and the anagarikas you support, and fair enough, you should get that. So anyway, make sure we get the right sort of quality of people in there. Now, number one, they have to sort of endure a lot as a monk. They have to, you know, listen to many, many more bad jokes than you get here. You only get it once every Friday night. They get it every week. But anyway, what was that joke I was going to say? I forget it now anyway. It'll probably come to me later on. Unless somebody is actually blocking me psychically from inflicting it on you. But anyway, this poor gentleman, and one of our rules, we're not supposed to eat afternoon at night time. That's one of our major rules. And this young trainee, he came to see me early in the morning. He said, I haven't slept all night. I feel so guilty. I feel so bad. I've broken one of my precepts. I was hungry last night. And I went into the kitchen. And there was no one there. And I made myself a sandwich. And I ate it. He felt so bad. And so, I told him straight away, I said, listen, wonderful, well done, you've actually owned up. You know, you told me. That's a wonderful thing to do. You make a mistake, let people know. Number two, sort of, you know, you're forgiven, but we can learn from this. You know, there's so many other allowables. And you wouldn't believe the sorts of things we can eat in the afternoon. You know, like chocolate. And you can have honey, you can have fruit juice. What else can you have? Heaps of stuff. And anyway, so you know, have some of those stuff. If you feel really hungry in the afternoon, have that stuff. And also, eat more for lunch. I said, okay. He said, that's a good idea. So you won't feel hungry. So you don't have to break your precepts. So a lot of the time, we don't just say, you know, don't break precepts. And there's a reason for it. You know, why? Why does this happen? And says, find the cause, and then look at the cause, and then the problem's usually over. So, for him, he said, okay, that's a good idea. And I said, okay, you can go now. He said, what? You mean there's no punishment? You're not going to sort of make me clean the toilets or do extra work? I said, of course there's no punishment. We don't do punishment. That's what I really loved about Buddhism. You know, no punishment. I said, well, if you don't punish me, he said, I'll probably do the same again tonight. You know, some people are like that. You know, you've got to sort of, you know, have some sort of penance, to have some deterrent. Otherwise, you know, they think they're going to keep on doing bad stuff. So he wanted some deterrent. So he wanted a punishment. And so I had to really think on the spot, well, how can you punish guys in Buddhist monastery? And it just came to me because, you know, I was reading about the history of Australia and what they used to do to people who broke the law, you know, over 200 years ago. They would be flogged with this brutal cat of nine tails. I'd just been reading about that. And so I looked at him and said, well, if you want an Australian punishment, a traditional one, I'm going to give you, sentence you to 50 strokes of the cat. And this fellow, you know, he didn't have any understanding of what Buddhism was. His face went white, even whiter than the clothes he was wearing. And, you know, his lips started to quiver, you know, as people do when they're really afraid. And he really thought that he was going to be whipped. Until I told him what 50 strokes of the cat means in a Buddhist monastery. At that time, we had two cats. Find one of them, they'll be very compliant, and stroke it. One, that's one stroke. Two strokes. Three strokes. Learn some compassion and kindness. Because that was the thing he was missing more than anything else. So to this day, the punishment for doing bad things is actually either 50 strokes of the cat, if you can find the cat these days. We don't have any dogs. But we do have many teddy bears. So find a teddy bear, give that 50 strokes. Same, same. In other words, there's some kindness. So you don't need. And that's something which you can learn from a pet. Pet therapy. Which is why we have many dogs allowed, permitted, even encouraged, once they're, you know, properly trained, to go into hospitals. To be able to, you know, just to be around a person who's suffering, so people can actually stroke them, pat them. The compassion and kindness which that animal gives you has huge effects. One of the other things, disciples, you know, over in BSV in Melbourne, I shouldn't know, maybe shouldn't say her name, but when she had a dog, a beautiful Labrador, you know, she was a doctor. And she decided, you know, that, you know, she saw this. She was a Buddhist, a doctor, and so she decided to get a dog and to train the dog, you know, to be one of these pet therapy. And you know what she called her dog? Chemo. Short for chemotherapy. Taking her out. That was a beautiful little dog. And I would insist the dog would always come and see me whenever I went to Melbourne. And I was, I don't know about that. I don't know what was chemo when she only passed away, I think, last year. Yeah, 16 or 17 years, good old chemotherapy. Beautiful Labrador. I would always come out. Last time was a bit shaky, but that dog made a lot of good karma. So helping so many really nice people for such a long time. So, you know, even dogs can actually, obviously they can do great stuff. So, Buddhism and the year of the dog. So, we don't just look at these animals as somehow inferior, but, you know, they can be great companions. And they can teach us a lot about kindness and love and faithfulness and the ability that we can learn just from them, just how to be faithful and not complain. To be able to look at you with these beautiful big doggy eyes and just to give you this unconditional kindness and love. Now, if a dog can do that, why can't you? Did a dog have to be trained to do that? Or is it something natural? You know, a lot of times, you know, in this world of ours, we always, you know, want to be trained. Come and train how to do meditation. Come and train how to be wise. Come and train to be compassionate. You know, a lot of times when we get rid of a lot of our fear and be a bit more natural, at ease. You know, sometimes, and take a bit more time, don't worry what other people think of you. Just sleep more. That's a radical spiritual training. training. And just learn the great wisdom, you know, from one of our closest friends, the dog. Man's woman's best friend. Could you even call them the old Kalyanamitta? A good friend we can learn from? It's an old Buddhist term. So anyway, pushing the envelope a little bit there, we're learning from nature. Learning. And you know, just finishing off, there are many similarities between, I'm getting into trouble for this as well, between monks and dogs. And this came up because that, I hope I'm not getting too much trouble for this. I know it goes against people's traditions and understandings, but sometimes we've got to think in different ways to make wisdom happen. When the first monks went to UK, you know, from Thailand, one who was the head of the English Sangha Trust at the time, he was a lecturer in economics in one of the big universities, and also he was a director of the Bank of England. He was a top economist. And so he was also, you know, Buddhist, so they asked him, can we afford to look after monks and nuns, you know, coming to this country? How much do they cost? So he did the crunching of the numbers. And he came out with this amazing result. He said, looking after a monk, you know, like a good forest monk, a good nun, you know, living simply, is much less cost than having a pet dog. Your dogs actually cost much more. So, every home should have one. Forget about dogs and cats, you know, have a pet monk or a pet nun. Now, we get the similarities. You've seen where monks live. They live in it's a bit bigger than a kennel, but it's the same idea. You put them in the back of a car. And monks, nuns, we eat out of bowls. And you watch tomorrow morning, we go on an arms round. We take you for a walk. Well, you take us for a walk. It's called Bindabas. And we'll always wag our tails if we had one. And always very, very kind and wise, and lots of compassion and kindness as well. So in this year of the dog, we're not being critical. I know that sometimes people they have the idea that dogs are really sort of low, and comparing the high monks to be like dogs, and that may be a bit sort of offensive to some people, but please don't take offense. And whatever simile, you can always put it this way and put it that way. Just make sure that just you get the very, very best. The best similes, the best wisdom from somebody who you can actually be with and can teach you so much loving kindness. And eventually when the dog passes away, remember that wonderful time you've had together, and you can have a beautiful memory of all the things your animals have taught you. Wonderful thing to have. Okay, so I think I can see the not the dogs now, but some bigger animals coming in soon to celebrate the year of the dog. And it's actually some lions. But before we actually do that, is there any quick questions before we start? I'll do quick ones. Yeah. Okay, to answer that question, you will have everything answered on Sunday when we do the Sutta class. So one of the most amazing things in Buddhism is to be patient. Just wait, and then after a while, it'll all be revealed to you on Sunday. Because it's not relevant to the talk this evening. Was any on the internet? We'll do those quickly, and then we're going to have the... celebrating the lion ducks. Great, quick ones here. Ajahn Brahm from Jerry. Does a dog have Buddha nature? Well, it has a bark, and within the bark is the essence, so woof. Of course it has Buddha nature. It can be kind. US dogs don't need weapons for survival. How can humans be wise and survive in a gun-free, weapons-free world? Thanks. You know, because why in the dog... sometimes if you have a dog... okay, no, that joke doesn't work. Okay, this is a kid's one. What goes woof, woof, tick, tick? Watchdog. In a gun-free, weapons-free world, thank you. Again, it's only when we have that trust. And look, sometimes that's a wonderful therapy, you know, which for people who are mentally disturbed, or who, I remember just some of the great work which was done with people who had done some terrible crimes, you know, who are even a bit psychotic, psychopathic, just training a dog, you know, getting it from a puppy, and learning from that puppy, you know, to have empathy. Empathy can be learned. It's not something in your brain which is missing. That's my understanding of it. So, how can we be wise and survive in a gun-free, weapons-free world is, you know, to be able to see if we can have more kindness, more, and we learn a lot of that from dogs and cats. In a modern world, there is so much affection towards dogs and cats. What can Buddhists do to make people respect all animals the same? Is actually, we don't have enough affection towards our dogs and cats, and we look down upon them instead of learning from them. So maybe look at nature, learn from them, and then maybe we can have a bit more respect for all beings. It's not just all beings, because sometimes we have people who are somehow different than us. Somehow they're stigmatized because of their color, their race, how they dress, or just their age, or any other what we call, you know, disability. And so I think that we can learn to be kind to all beings. Learn from one another. So I'm rushing through those questions because now we have the lions are waiting outside. And if we keep the lions waiting for too long, they may get...
There's a delay.
A delay? Yeah, okay. 9:29:30. We're going to wait. Okay. Okay. So, you got the latest? Because remember, Eddie, I made you a suggestion. I think you should do this. Because if we can't have the real lions dancing, then I think, Eddie, you could imitate the lion dancing. You can make the best of it. I thought they were outside there. So if you... Okay, not yet. Okay. So, how we can learn from dogs. Dogs are much wiser than people think, because, you know, when we don't discriminate between people or animals these days, that's where we had the story of the person who told me this. They were working in the European Union in Brussels. And in Brussels, the European Union, they have a very, very strict non-discrimination policy. Didn't tell this last week, did I? No, good. The if you need to go because the lions aren't coming for another half an hour, so but be careful, you might meet them on the road on the way here. So if you do, please look after them. Otherwise, anyway, the European Union in Brussels, non-discrimination, doesn't matter what religion, doesn't matter what age, any disability, any gender, as long as you can do the job, you get the job. So they were advertising for a secretary and a non-discrimination. So a dog applied for the position. And, you know, they said, we don't employ dogs. And the dog, with its paw pointed, non-discrimination. If you can do the job, you get the job. So, okay. So they told him, go and type a letter. So this little dog, he jumped up on the little office seat, opened up the computer, turned on Office Word, and typed a perfect letter with his paws. It was amazing. You know, a cat couldn't do that. It'd be playing with a mouse all the time. But the dog can.
Oh, come on. I'm making up as I go along. Give me a break.
Anyway, so the dog was typed a letter. Okay, good. But the next thing, we need to do a spreadsheet, you know, for accounts. So I opened up Microsoft Excel, and just a perfect spreadsheet. And I said, oh my goodness. The other thing he said, because this is Brussels, Europe, you have to be bilingual. You have to speak a second language. So the dog went, meow, meow. Okay, I'll try my best. Okay, modern times, the great dogs, because they're great at sniffing things. So, I don't know if these, I'll make it up as quick as I go along before they come. The dog, I was on an aircraft, and I was sitting on the window seat, and next to me was a gentleman, and on the aisle seat was a dog. And I've never seen that on an aircraft before, having dogs on the aircraft. And so he asked the man sitting next to me, who was the handler of the dog, he said, this is security. It's a security dog. Look, I'll show you how it works. And so he sent the dog down the aisle, and they sniffed, you know, this little backpacker, and came back, and barked once, wagged its tail. Said, oh, that is a sign that fellow's carrying marijuana. We'll catch him when we get to the other end. And let's see what else we got. Then they went up to business class, and the dog sniffed another lady, very well dressed, barked twice, and wagged its tail. Said, oh, that's cocaine. We've got a cocaine smuggler on it. Let's see what's in first class. Went up to first class, and smelled this really well dressed gentleman, barked three times. And wagged its tail really hard. That is heroin. We've got a heroin smuggler on here as well. It's amazing. Just this dog can smell anything. Let's see what else it's got. So went into premium economy and smelled another fellow. Smelled another fellow and came back, didn't bark, started whining. Put its tail between its legs and pooped on the chair. He said, oh my goodness, that's a sign there's a bomb on the plane. A bomb. Okay. Pooped. Wind. Okay. Okay. the last dog joke.
The year of the dog. I'm really scraping the barrel now because these blooming lions should be here by now. If they were dogs, they'd be on time.
So anyway, they're more faithful. So anyway, this fellow, he passes, because who's leaving now? Passes this Sri Lankan temple. So you've got to stay for this, Alanda. He passes the Sri Lankan temple and there's this beautiful Sri Lankan food fair. Lots and lots and lots of food. But, and the guy, you know, two guys with their dogs, you know, one had a Labrador, the one has a Chihuahua. And they said, wow, let's get some of this lovely, delicious free food. And of course the person said, no, I'm sorry, no dogs allowed in the temple. And the guy with the Labrador says, this is my guide dog, and I'm blind. So, oh, okay, you can go in. So he went in there and had a beautiful, delicious food. And then the other guy said, oh, I'm going to try this with his Chihuahua. And he said, you can't go in. No dogs. He said, well, it's my guide dog. I'm blind. And I'll come off it. It's a Chihuahua. He said, my goodness. And they gave me a Chihuahua? He couldn't see it. Okay. Okay. Fucking dog. Okay. Any more dog jokes? A cup of tea. A cup of tea, that's a good idea. So, but there's not going to be many people left for the lions. So, they might feed me to the lions after this one. So, anyway, but be careful. If you do have a dog, there's those two fellows who are saying, you know, a dog is actually a good companion in life. And he said, oh, yeah, I think I'm getting a nice Labrador. He said, don't. Any dog, but don't ever get a Labrador. He says, why is that? Because haven't you noticed people who get Labradors go blind? Okay. I'm getting big trouble there. Okay, look, I think that's probably enough, because I'm running out of Labrador jokes, and many of you are running out too. So anyway, we'll do what we can to see if we get any the lions in. So we do. It's not my fault. So please don't blame the establishment. So anyway, we can do now just pay respects to the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha, and then if we need to disappear, we can. And have a cup of tea if you wish. If some of you can stay for the, especially if you've got the kids, because the kids really look forward to the lions. Okay, here we go. So, yeah, we'll just... No, don't, not sadhu. Woof, woof. Three woofs. Okay, now let's just bow a few times to Buddha Dhamma Sangha first. Or we'll get in trouble of being disrespectful.
Arahant Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhaṃ Bhagavantaṃ Abhivadayami Suvakkato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammaṃ Namassāmi Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sangham Namami.
I tried my best.
Remember and beyond.
Beyond my face.